Well, welcome to the Epic Podcast, a chronological journey through the Old Testament with Michelle Nietling. This is episode 20, and we are covering the last stretch of David's reign from 2 Samuel 20 to 24 and 1 Chronicles 21 to 26. For some of us, last episode felt a little like a roller coaster of emotion, stirring old regrets, exposing our desperate desire for God to somehow work out the messes we've made, and then sighing in relief as we realized he leads us on a GPS calibrated by his heart, programmed to a fixed, unchanging coordinate, always pointing us home to our Father. David was a man after God's own heart, but he was still just a man, frail, flawed, and vulnerable to sin. He loved God like no other. God's presence was his lifeblood, and yet he stumbled like all of us. But David's story gives us hope because it reveals the heart of the God we serve, merciful, gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. Yes, Bathsheba was his weakness. Yes, having her husband killed was unspeakable. And yes, he was unable to forgive himself. But God forgave him. Even though they lost the son born from that brokenness, God gave them Solomon, a son who would not only redeem David's story, but point forward to the glory still to come. Solomon was a foreshadowing of a greater son, a coming king, one who would sit on David's throne forever. God's answer is always grace. Last episode, through David, we learned that when we mess up, we can run to God's mercy. We can ask Holy Spirit to help us, to bring solutions, to soften hearts, to walk with us through the fire. David clung to that truth. He did not retaliate when Absalom rebelled. Instead, he wept. He never fought to preserve his throne. He chose rather to trust the sovereignty of God. Like Jacob, who wrestled the angel and cried out, "Surely the Lord is in this place." David recognized God's hand in every moment, even when Shammai cursed him, accusing him of bringing all this ruin upon himself. David didn't argue. He didn't strike back. He simply said, "Perhaps the Lord told him to say it." Because in his core, David believed if adversity has come, then it has first passed through the hands of the sovereign and faithful God. And now in 2 Samuel 19, we pick up the story with David still east of the Jordan River. He had been hiding there from Absalom, who had taken his throne. But now Absalom and his 20,000 men are dead. All the northern tribes who had sided with Absalom were left without a king. Only the men of Judah were with David. Absalom's rebellion truly left its scar. The nation was fragmented, groping for unity and healing. The 10 northern tribes of Israel discussed bringing David back and reinstating him as their king long before Judah even thought of it. I am sure Judah decided that the opposition had sided with Absalom after all. They probably thought they were the only ones who had a right to call David king. But when David heard the 10 tribes were thinking of reinstating him, he challenged his own people. In a move to settle the tension, he reinstated Amasa, who had sided with Absalom, as his commander in the place of Joab. Replacing Joab with Amasa was a bold gesture of unity, an olive branch to those who had followed Absalom. He was implying that he wasn't returning to punish, but to restore. Realizing they had to take charge and be seen as the ones escorting David across the Jordan River, they took action immediately, deliberately leaving the rest of Israel out of the process. Needless to say, the 10 northern tribes felt this was a strategic move on behalf of Judah, a power play. Clearly upset, they pressed, "Why did Judah steal the king away?" Judah quick to defend, "He's our brother, our people." But Israel claimed they had more right to the king than they did. "We have 10 shares in the king." Let us just pause here for a moment. It may sound like a tribal dispute, Judah versus the 10 northern tribes, but it's more than a complaint. It's a cry to belong, a claim to the king. Prophetically, it actually foreshadows the division that would come in 1 Kings 12 when the kingdom splits in two. 10 tribes to the north, led by Jeroboam, and 2 in the south, remaining loyal to David's line. The unified kingdom fractures, and for centuries the northern tribes fade into obscurity and lost. This wasn't simply about who got across the river with the king. It was about who had a voice in the restoration, the new kingdom of Israel. While all this was going on, a man named Sheba, a Benjamite of no real consequence, no rank, and certainly no royal blood, saw an opportunity to promote himself. He could see that the 10 tribes of Israel were vulnerable and could be easily swayed. He blew the trumpet and shouted, "We have no share in David, no part in Jesse's son. Every man to his tent, Israel." And it worked. Those around him followed him. Folks, we must remember this wasn't the modern era. There were no phones, no social media, no fast ways to correct misinformation or spread urgent news. They depended on messengers, runners, and riders, often taking days to reach their destination. Decisions were often made without all the facts. News of David's reinstatement as king had not yet reached everyone's ears. When David heard about it, he had to act quickly before Sheba could sway the nation. He told Amasa, his new general, "You've got 3 days to rally the troops. We need to do something." But for some or other reason, after 3 days, Amasa never returned. Desperate, David turned to his nephew, Abishai, to get the job done. He couldn't afford to wait any longer. David was completely unaware that Joab, still upset that he'd been replaced by Amasa, had actually killed him. In the meantime, Joab caught up with Sheba in Abel Beth Maacah. His troops surrounded the city, ready to tear it down, but a wise woman intervened. To save their peaceful city, she persuaded the city to kill Sheba instead and throw his head over the wall. When it was done, Joab blew the trumpet. The threat to David's throne silenced for now. David was reinstated and continued to rule. But life is a journey, and the terrain is our most persistent teacher. A famine struck the land, not just for 1 year, but for 3 years in a row. This wasn't just a natural crisis. It felt like a spiritual silence. Something was off. David did what we must all learn to do in dry, confusing seasons. He sought the Lord. And the Lord answered, "This is because of Saul, because of the blood he shed when he broke covenant with the Gibeonites." This had nothing to do with David, but he had to deal with it. Let's pause here. This was about something that happened long before David's reign. If you remember the story in Joshua, Israel had made a peace treaty with the Gibeonites. Yes, they had been tricked into it, but once the vow was made before the Lord, it mattered. Years later, Saul, in his misguided zeal, violated that covenant. He tried to wipe out the Gibeonites, thinking he was doing Israel a favor. But in doing so, he brought a curse upon the land. Now David had to make it right. He summoned the Gibeonites and asked, "What must I do to make atonement?" Their answer was weighty. They didn't want silver or war. They wanted justice. 7 of Saul's male descendants. David agreed, but he insisted they spare Mephibosheth, Jonathan's son, because he would not break his covenant with his brother-in-law. So he handed over 2 sons of Rizpah, one of Saul's concubines, and 5 sons of Merab, Saul's daughter. The Gibeonites executed them and left their bodies exposed on the hillside before the Lord. Folks, I cannot explain this. I am merely recounting the story. But this is the Old Testament, the Old Covenant. Jesus would come for this very reason, to die for us once and for all, to take upon himself the punishment required in the Old Testament. The law had to be fulfilled, justice had to be served, and in the New Covenant, Jesus would sacrifice himself. He would suffer so that we never find ourselves in this situation. Saul's concubine Rizpah, a grieving mother, refused to let disgrace have the final word. She laid out sackcloth on a rock beside the bodies of her sons, and for months, through the harvest season, she kept watch. She drove away birds by day and wild animals by night. She didn't leave. She didn't move. She just stayed. And when David heard about it, he was moved. He gathered the bones of Saul and Jonathan from Jabesh Gilead, along with the remains of the executed sons, and he gave them all a proper burial in the tomb of Saul's father. Only then does Scripture say, God answered the prayer on behalf of the land. The land was restored, and David looked back over the years, the heartbreaks, the victories. As his memories gathered, they found their voice in a song he had written, "The Lord is my rock, my fortress, and my deliverer." Now we pick up the story in 2 Samuel 24 and 1 Chronicles 21. Two accounts, one event, two different lenses. It began with a stirring, a quiet nudge. In 2 Samuel it says, "Again the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, 'Go and take a census of Israel and Judah.'" But 1 Chronicles tells it like this: "Satan rose up against Israel and incited David to take a census." Did you catch that? One points to God, the other to Satan. Both reveal a deeper truth. God allowed it, Satan provoked it, and David acted on it. God was exposing a crack in David's heart, one that he hadn't seen. Pride. He had once trusted only in the Lord, facing lions, giants, and armies without ever needing to count anything. But now, with the crown secure and borders expanded, David wanted to measure his strength. Not in God's presence, but in numbers. Even Joab, the hardened commander, knew this was a bad idea. "Why would my lord the king desire to do such a thing?" he asked. But David overruled him. For 9 months and 20 days, the census rolled across the land, and when the final number came, 1.3 million sword-bearing men. As soon as David heard the number, his heart was convicted. "I have sinned greatly in what I have done." But it was too late. His pride had opened a door, and the people who had followed him, rejoiced in him, wept for him, now stood under judgment. But this was not only about David's pride. This was a nation who had angered the Lord. Folks, we need to remember, God may allow Satan to press us, but it's not to destroy us. It's to draw out what's hidden in our hearts and to lead us into a deeper surrender. Then the Lord sent the prophet Gad to David. David could choose one of three options of judgment: 3 years of famine, 3 months fleeing before enemies, or 3 days of plague. But David knew God's character and he didn't hesitate. "Let me fall into the hands of the Lord, for his mercy is very great. But do not let me fall into human hands." And so, for 3 relentless days, plague swept the land. From Dan to Beersheba, 70,000 people died. And just as the angel reached Jerusalem, poised to strike again, God said, "Enough." Even in judgment, God remained in control. The angel of the Lord was standing at the threshing floor of Arunah, the Jebusite, a simple elevated field just outside Jerusalem. David felt responsible for the suffering and cried out, "I have sinned, I, the shepherd, but these are just sheep. Let your hand fall on me and my family." Then came the instruction, "Build an altar right there on that ground." Arunah was prepared to give him the land for free, along with the oxen and wood, but David refused. "I will not offer to the Lord that which cost me nothing." So he paid the full price, built the altar, and made the offering. This threshing floor, a place of judgment, became a turning point. It would one day become the foundation of Solomon's temple, the very site where sacrifices would be offered for generations and where the presence of God would dwell. The throne might be strong. We might think we are strong. But if pride is at the center, God will shake it, because God is not impressed by numbers or outward success. He wants a heart that knows, "My strength comes from the Lord alone." When we encounter God in our shame and brokenness on the threshing floor, right there, He establishes his temple on that piece of ground in our hearts, where we are surrendered, where it costs us. There he creates a place to dwell. Now we pick up the story in 1 Kings 1 and 2 and 1 Chronicles 22 to 26. David had grown old and he struggled to stay warm at night. His servants found a young Shunammite virgin, Abishag, to take care of him and keep him warm. Everyone knew David's days were numbered and everyone was wondering who would succeed him on the throne. Adonijah, David's eldest surviving son, seemed the obvious choice, and he certainly didn't waste any time. Confident and charismatic, just as handsome as Absalom, he crowned himself king. No one objected, since it was his right and he looked the part. Just to be sure, he secured the support of Joab and Abiathar the priest, but not that of Zadok, Benaiah, or Nathan the prophet. Nevertheless, he held a grand feast, inviting all the royal officials of Judah and his supporters. David had no idea what was going on behind his back. Nathan the prophet knew God's blueprint, and he had to warn Bathsheba. "Let me advise you how to save your life and the life of your son Solomon." Then he told her to remind David of his oath to her. "Surely Solomon your son shall be king after me." This was based on the covenant the Lord had made with David in 2 Samuel 7, 12-16. "I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever." Nathan promised to follow and confirm her words. Then Bathsheba approached David. "My lord the king, did you not declare that Solomon would reign after you? Why then has Adonijah become king? The eyes of all Israel are on you to learn who will sit on your throne." Before David could respond, Nathan entered and repeated her words. Even though he knew his son Solomon was still young, he said, "As surely as the Lord lives, I will carry out today what I swore. Solomon shall be king after me." David commanded them to anoint him king at Gihon. "Blow the trumpet and shout, 'Long live King Solomon! He shall sit on my throne and reign in my place.'" Adonijah and his guests were still celebrating when they heard the city erupt. Jonathan, son of Abiathar, burst through the door and dropped the bombshell. "Our Lord, King David has made Solomon king. They've placed him on the king's mule. Zadok and Nathan anointed him at Gihon. He now sits on the royal throne. Even the officials have blessed him, saying, 'May Solomon's name be greater than David's.'" Adonijah's guests feared for their lives. Adonijah, just as terrified, ran to the sanctuary and clung to the horns of the altar. When Solomon heard what happened, he sent out a search party. When they found him, he begged for mercy. Even then, as young as he was, Solomon responded with grace. David gathered all the officials, commanders, priests, and leaders of Israel. "I'm about to go the way of all the earth," he told Solomon. "So be strong, act like a man, walk in obedience to the Lord your God, keep his commands, and you will prosper." But David didn't just leave his son with words, he left blueprints. He had drawn up the architectural plans for the temple, not a tent like in the wilderness, but a permanent place for the presence of God. He assigned the divisions of priests, Levites, the gatekeepers, the musicians, every sacred duty organized. Every resource was prepared: tons of gold for the gold work, silver for the silver, bronze for the bronze, cedar from Lebanon, iron, stone, jewels. This wasn't just building a structure. This was establishing a place of worship and a way of worship. David gave from the royal treasury, and then he went further. He gave from his own personal stores, his own gold and silver. And then he asked a bold question: "Who else is willing to consecrate themselves today to the Lord?" And the leaders responded, and they gave generously. Because David wasn't just raising funds, he was inviting a nation to invest in the future of their worship. And when the giving was done, David didn't boast. He lifted his eyes to heaven and he prayed, "Everything comes from you, and we have given you only what comes from your hand. But more than resources, David offers something greater, a father's prayer. With trembling lips and a tender heart, he entrusts Solomon to the Lord. Give my son wholehearted devotion, he prays. David's legacy isn't just a throne, it's a future grounded in worship, built not on ambition, but surrender. Before David would leave this earth, he had a few things to settle. He told Solomon to deal with Joab for killing Abner and Amasa. Deal with him according to your wisdom, but do not let his gray head go down to the grave in peace. Then he urged Solomon to show kindness to the sons of Barzillai of Gilead and let them eat at his table, since they had stood by him when he fled from Absalom. And then came Shammai, the Benjamite who had cursed David bitterly in Mahanaim. But now, do not consider him innocent. You're a man of wisdom. You will know what to do to him. Bring his gray head down to the grave in blood. Then David died, after ruling Israel for 40 years, beginning in Hebron. It wasn't long before Adonijah failed his test. Instead of proving himself worthy, he exposed the ambition still lurking in his heart. He went to Bathsheba, Solomon's mother. I have something to say to you. As you know, the kingdom was mine. All Israel looked to me as their king. But things changed, and the kingdom has gone to my brother, for it came to him from the Lord. Now I have one request. Do not refuse me. You may make it, she said. Please ask King Solomon. He will not refuse you to give me Abishag the Shunammite as my wife. Very well, Bathsheba said. I will speak to the king for you. Now we must remember that Abishag the Shunammite was the young virgin given to David to keep him warm at night. Asking for a king's concubine was as good as declaring, I'm taking over the throne. When Bathsheba approached the king, he was open to what she had to say. I have one small request to make of you. Do not refuse me. Make it, mother. I will not refuse you. Then she said, let Abishag the Shunammite be given in marriage to your brother Adonijah. Solomon was horrified. How can you ask such a thing? You might as well have asked me to give him the kingdom. Then he declared, Adonijah shall be put to death today. So Solomon gave the order and settled all that needed sorting. Adonijah was put to death, and also Joab, not only for supporting Adonijah, but for killing Abner and Amasa during his father's reign. Solomon put Benaiah in charge of Israel's army in Joab's place. He also reshuffled the priesthood. He removed Abiathar the priest for treason, and he replaced him with Zadok. Solomon still had to deal with Shimei, since David had left him with a dying request. Remember, Shimei was part of Saul's clan, and he had falsely accused David, cursing him while he was in a dark place fleeing from Absalom. King Solomon gave Shimei one condition for mercy: stay in Jerusalem and never cross the Kidron Valley. If he did, he would die. Shimei agreed and remained there for 3 years. Unfortunately, he did not keep his word, and justice was carried out, reinforcing the seriousness of Solomon's rule. Now that David had passed away, stepping into his shoes was no small task, since Solomon's father had left him an incredible legacy, not just in wealth and power, and not just in land and dominion, but also the weight of establishing the worship of the Lord in his people and keeping God's presence in the center of it all. Solomon was also young and untested. He did not have the history his father had with the Lord. He still had to build and grow in his own experience of being shaped, pruned, and standing in faith. His father modeled a life of living abandoned to the Lord, and now he needed to steward all that he had inherited and consider the legacy he might leave the next generation. At this stage, the Ark of the Covenant rested in Jerusalem, in the tent David had prepared, but the ancient bronze altar, crafted in the wilderness, still stood in Gibeon, in the tent of meeting. Now that Solomon had established himself as king, he needed God more than ever. So he gathered Israel's leaders and made his way to the altar in Gibeon, where he made 1,000 sacrifices. That night, God appeared to him in a dream with an open invitation that would define a kingdom. Solomon, ask me whatever you want and I will give it to you. In humility of heart, Solomon begins his supplication. You were faithful to my father David. You showed him steadfast love because of his heart before you. And now here I am, his son, sitting on the throne, not because I'm ready, but because you placed me here. I'm young, I don't know how to lead. And this people, they are not mine, they are yours. They are many, great in number and chosen by you. So I'm not asking for wealth or victory. I'm asking for wisdom, for a discerning heart, to judge rightly and to lead well, to know good from evil. Who could ever imagine the parental love and pride of that precious moment when Father in Heaven held the face of his beloved son Solomon, Judea, in his hands? How could he refuse such love and genuineness of heart, so aligned with his and so in tune with heaven's blueprint? The Lord gave him what he asked, a wise and discerning heart like no other. But God didn't stop there. He added wealth and he added honor. The floodgates of his heart wide open and generous. And it makes me think of Ephesians 3:20. The God who is able to do exceedingly, abundantly, above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us. No sooner had Solomon asked for wisdom when God presented him a case to judge, and in so doing displayed to the world Solomon's wisdom. I am sure we all know it. Two women came to Solomon, each claiming to be the mother of the same child. One said, "She swapped her dead baby for mine while I was sleeping." But the other denied it. Solomon said, "Bring me a sword. Let us cut the child in two and give half to each." The real mother cried, "Please, give her the baby rather. Just don't kill him." And the other said, "Neither of us shall have him. Divide him." Then Solomon gave the verdict, "Give the child to the first woman. She is his mother." God didn't just give Solomon wisdom. He poured it out. Insight, depth, and understanding that stretched wider than the sand on the seashore. His wisdom outshone everyone near and far. He spoke 3,000 proverbs and wrote over 1,000 songs. He studied everything from towering cedars to tiny hyssop plants, from animals to birds, reptiles to fish. And people from every nation, sent by kings across the earth, came to hear the wisdom that God had placed in him. David did not only leave him a kingdom to rule, but something of greater significance, something eternal. David left Solomon with blueprints born in heaven. His father had recorded them like a psalm, stone by stone, beam by beam. He ordered the gold, he gathered the cedar, he orchestrated choirs of Levites and trained generations of gatekeepers. And then he entrusted it all to Solomon, not just a kingdom, but a calling. Not just a dream, but the holy burden of fulfilling the blueprint. Let us pause for a moment. This story so easily sweeps us up in fantasy and grandeur, but there is something much deeper happening here. There's something so current. Let's not miss it. Now the moment had come. The blueprints lay before him, heavy with promise. The throne was secure. Peace surrounded him. But heaven wasn't looking at his crown. Heaven was watching the foundations. Would Solomon build what was in God's heart, or merely what was on David's plans? Because blueprints are only the beginning. What will he do with what he has inherited? And more importantly, what will we do? Folks, the stones are ready. The gold is waiting. The cloud is watching. And the glory has yet to fall. Well, folks, we'll have to wait until the next episode to see how it all unfolds. In the meantime, please share these episodes with your friends and family. Let's work together to spread the word of God and reignite a passion for the powerful, often overlooked stories of the Old Testament. Don't forget to like and subscribe to the Epic Podcast on YouTube, a chronological and visual journey through the Old Testament. You can find me under Michelle Neathling 6170. The Epic Podcast. You can also follow me on social media, Facebook, Michelle Neathling Art, Instagram, Michelle Neathling Art. And remember, that's Michelle with just one L. Check out my website, intuitiveprophetic art.co.za. If you'd like a beautiful hardcover edition of my book, The Epic, a chronological and visual guide through the Old Testament, you can order directly from me at michellenethlingart@gmail.com. Both books, Crossing the Jordan River and The Epic, are available on Takealot South Africa and soon to be on Amazon internationally.